Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Colonel David Hunt on the line with us. He has a new book out, On the Hunt, How to Wake Up Washington and Win the War on Terror. He's a retired Army colonel and regular correspondent with Fox News. Colonel Hunt, welcome to the program.
All right, good. Thanks, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. Glad to have you here with us. There's a couple things in your book that I think are just really spot on, and a couple things that I'd like to have a conversation with you about. First of all, your hands-off chapter, you talk about the Patriot Act and what a horrible mistake the Patriot Act is, and it's stripping us of our civil liberties. Let me give you an opportunity to rant about that for a second.
We were American citizens. We get rights, and I spent 30 years of my life, and a lot of great guys defending that. Nobody, I mean nobody, gets to take that. Now, if I'm a terrorist, a terrorist suspect, throw me in jail, give me a lawyer, put me in trial, find me guilty, and electrocute my ass. That's fine, but we cannot allow American citizens to be held incommunicado anywhere in the world, but certainly not in our own country. It's gone nuts. It's not that these are bad guys that are American citizens, but we diminish ourselves when we do that. There's nothing wrong. Nothing wrong with giving a bad guy a lawyer. And if the lawyer, you know, spills secrets or is communicating with terrorists, then we'll put the lawyer in jail. But to me,
bottom line is, if he's a bad guy, we nail him, and if he's not, then we want to be. That's the whole idea of the Republican form of government, of our democratic institutions, is to defend the rights of individuals against the force and power of government.
Of course, and what happens in time of war, and something as scary as 9/11, we overreacted. I want it brought back. I am not suggesting that Padilla or any of the other guys are not bad guys. I am telling you that when you get rights. Now, if you're a bad man, again, I'll help. I'll pull the lever on the electric chair. I got no problem with that. I do have a problem with not getting a lawyer for 4 years and being held without any communication. It's wrong. It's not
right.
How.
Why, sir, are your friends on Fox News? You're on that show regularly. Why are they not with you on this? This just seems like common sense. This seems like it should transcend. I realize that, you know, the Fox Noise Machine is by and large the official house organ of the Republican Party.
Whoa.
But it seems that this should transcend politics. Well, you know, Roger Ailes used to work for Reagan. He writes the memo about the talking points. I get some of their memos, you know?
Okay, all right, well, that's fine. Let's do that one. If you want to do... Look, I'm just glad to see Air America.
No, I'm just curious why. If you had any insights into why the folks on the right oppose you on this.
Well,
you know,
it's a fair hit, but I mean, first of all, I don't speak for Fox. I get paid by him to do it. I've actually been kicked off of Fox for some of the things I've said. They have to speak for themselves. I have not been back in office for 3.5 years.
Okay. Well, I congratulate you on that.
The way this has been, and by the way, Judge Napolitano is a huge critic of the Patriot Act and taking stuff. Anybody in the judiciary would be.
Let me get to a couple of other issues here.
Yeah.
In an interview with Sean Hannity, you were asked, what about talking with Assad? What about talking with Syria? What about talking about with Ahmadinejad?
Yeah.
And your reply was,
I think we can talk to him, line him up and kill him. I don't think that'd be the talk to some of these guys.
You said we should line them up and kill them. That's how we talk to them. Now, what if Ronald Reagan had said to Gorbachev, "Sir, the only way I'll talk to you is to line you up and kill you"?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, you're right, and I don't get it right all the time, Tom. And you know what? Either to you, and either to your network.
You're right.
If you want to, I don't mind arguing Fox and Air America if that's what you want to do. But this is going to go south awful fast. I wrote this book to say this, that we have not got this right. That we have not fought this war correctly, and that we have lost rights in this war, and we shouldn't have. I have said outrageous stuff on Fox. I'll tell you this about Ahmadinejad. I would talk to him, but I also might consider arresting the son of a bitch. After a while, some of these guys don't get to say and do the things they're doing in a government. We just capitulated to them last week, Tom, with the Brits and the Americans over sailors that never should have been captured. But yeah, you're right. I'm sure you got a lot of sound bites in 4 years of my saying some outrageous stuff. But I've also said what I've said in that book, that as Americans, we should be very concerned with the way this war is being conducted, and because, not the Republican-Democrat issue, not because of Air America or Fox, but because this war is not going to get over.
But well, this is not a war. It's an occupation. We had a successful war.
See, we
attacked Iraq. We took down their government. We occupied their buildings. We destroyed their army.
Yep.
And that was a successful war. It lasted less than 3 months.
We've
had an unsuccessful, totally incompetent occupation for 4 years.
I put that in the book. But we had a national election, Tom, in 2004, and more people voted for American Idol than we did for president. And we had a chance. And what did we do? Your side decided to do what? Make Vietnam, Tom, the centerpiece of an election for president of the United States during a time of war and terrorism. I'm sorry, you had your shot and you blew it. Now you got your shot again. Do you want it right now with Democrats running?
You are suggesting. We're talking with Colonel David Hunt. He's got a new book out called On the Hunt. You're suggesting in your book that this is legitimately a war. In fact, here's one. You know, just a quote from the book. You say our focus needs to be on ensuring our survival.
Yeah.
So far, we've had 19 guys sneak through and hit us once. This seems to me more. If you look at how England has responded, how Great Britain has responded to two different series of terrorist confrontations, one that lasted over 40 years, the IRA, and now the London subway bombings. They said, these guys are criminals. They are insane. We are going to track them down. We're going to put their butts in jail. We are going to prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law, and the people got closure. This is what Bill Clinton did to Tim McVeigh when he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma. This is what Spain did against ETA, and now they have brought them kind of into the fold to all extent.
Okay.
You know, the people in the Basque territory are now, proud citizens of Spain. This is what Italy did with the Red Brigades. This is what Germany did with the Baader-Meinhof gang. In every case, when a country was confronted with what we have characterized as terrorism, they dealt with these people as criminals. They prosecuted them as criminals. Everybody got closure. End of discussion. Bush goes off on some crazed war and's got like guys like you saying it's a war on terror. I'm sorry, what we have is Osama bin Laden with fewer than 20,000 followers before Bush decided to make him into some sort of antichrist.
Tom.
Yeah.
How are you? How you doing?
Respond to it.
Are you okay?
That's
a lot of breath there, Tom. Look.
You're suggesting this is a war on terror. I'm saying it's a crime.
I had no issue with the Clinton administration making a criminal if they had done their jobs. If you have been, then go after criminals, Tom, not just... And they didn't get it done right, and they had chances to kill bin Laden. I'm not suggesting the Clinton administration's response to 9/11, but I know for a fact, John, I was in this business. I was in Bosnia. I was doing intel work, serious stuff for a long time. They turned their backs on opportunities. So if you're going to criminalize it, I have no problem with it, then go after the bad guy. They didn't. And I do not think that Iraq, I think Iraq, I wrote.
Well, the bad guy's bin Laden. He's still sitting in Pakistan having, smoking a cigarette.
He is. And I put that in the book. It's a mistake. I also.
Yeah, I know. You talked about how General Franks was afraid. I've read it. General Franks was afraid to risk the loss of manpower, the loss of life over finishing the job with bin Laden. But the point is that. Well, and also, if you're going to try and blame it on Clinton, I would point out to you that George W. Bush received 56 specific warnings that this thing was coming.
Tom, I'm saying,
and did absolutely nothing.
I wouldn't blame Clinton. I simply said, in following your line, that if you're going to criminalize it, which we did, and you're right about the examples of the Red Brigade and Germany I'll tell you what.
Every other country.
No. But what they didn't do was really prosecute. They played games with this stuff. I was involved in trying to get bin Laden, Tom, during the Clinton administration. We had, but I'm just telling you, if you're going to criminalize it, do it right. Don't make it politically correct. Actually go after these guys, and they didn't. But so did Bush. We have sucked at the war on terrorists for 40 years. My first book, which made the New York Times bestseller list, thank you very much, I said the same thing. President after president after president, yours included, and the Republicans, and oh, by the way, I'm a registered independent, have failed in the war on terror, and we're failing now. If we don't want to, and we're going to get this right, or we're all going to be praying to Mecca, because this is a serious war we don't seem to want to acknowledge.
Yeah, so you believe that if we don't fight them there, they're going to come over here?
No.
They're all going to buy a ticket on a plane to come over here?
I'm not justifying Iraq for that. I am telling you, though, that was
this country will never pray to Mecca because a couple of people have blown up some of our buildings.
No, we will. But we've got Wahhabist mosques in D.C., the most militant form of Islam. I think there's a line.
So let's expose it. Let's deal with it as a thought virus rather than as a war.
But we have government.
The language of war just further extrema.
What do you call what they did on 9/11? What do you call that?
I call it a high crime and misdemeanor.
A high crime misdemeanor, 3,000 people?
Yeah.
Tom, okay, that's fine. Then
this was not another government. This was not a state that did this. This was a criminal who did this.
It was a state sponsor of terrorism that allowed this to happen. Of course it was. Afghanistan. Of course.
You believe that the Taliban knew that was going to happen?
Mullah Omar was in on the planning. Of course he was. But the thing is, we Iraq overextended. I wrote the book to show the mistakes we've made to try to get it right.
We got to wrap it up, but you made your point and you made it well. Colonel David Hunt, his book, On the Hunt, How to Wake Up Washington and Win the War on Terror. Thanks for being with us.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news.
At 6 o'clock.
President Bush's surprise message. America is addicted to...
I must have dreamed a thousand dreams.
Helping you win the water cooler wars with Uncommon Sense and the Radical Middle. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Amazing. Amazing. The Bush administration is trying to get, and apparently unsuccessfully, a war czar. I mean, this is incredible. The language of the Russian aristocracy. We need a war czar. Well, wait a minute. This is a democracy. We don't have czars. And I don't think that there's a cabinet position called war czar. Does Bush want to create one? He's had 3 4-star generals now turn him down. What he's really looking for here is somebody to take the fall on the disaster in Iraq. What David Hunt and I, Colonel David Hunt and I, were just talking about, this entire so-called war on terrorism. Which brings us to our fascism alert for the day.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
Yes, indeed, this...
We're marching to...
From, I believe, the Associated Press... It's by Michael Rosten. Actually, it was published on Raw Story. Let me correct that. A top constitutional scholar from Princeton, rawstory.com, a top constitutional scholar from Princeton who gave a televised speech that slammed President George W. Bush's executive overreach was recently told that he'd been added to the Transportation Security Administration's terrorist watch list. Walter F. Murphy, the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence Emeritus at Princeton University, when inquiring at the airport why they wouldn't put his bags on a plane to Newark, he says, I was denied a boarding pass because I was on the terrorist watch list. When inquiring with the clerk why he was on the list, Murphy was asked if he had participated in any peace marches. The clerk from the airline said, we ban a lot of people because of that. Murphy then explained that he had not marched, but had, quote, in September 2006, given a lecture at Princeton, televised and put on the web, highly critical of George Bush for his many violations of the Constitution. The clerk at the airline responded, that'll do it. Murphy was allowed to board the plane, but he was warned that his luggage would be ransacked on his return trip. His luggage was lost. Murphy, by the way, a decorated Marine who served in the Korean War and in the reserves for 19 years. Our fascism alert for the day. Yes, indeed. Springtime for something. This is pretty grim. The talking points, by the way, on Don Imus just keep on spinning. Yesterday, the local Channel 6 dropped by a TV station, and basically my take on it was, you know, enough with the hate speech already right across the board. The conservative rebuttal is, oh, but conservatives do hate speech only against high-profile people, and so that puts them in a different category. Because Imus was doing hate speech against, you know, a girls' basketball team, a college basketball team, young women. And arguably, if it was true, there would be some, you know, there would be a point there. You know, if Limbaugh makes racist jokes about, you know, Barack Obama, as he has, hey, that's Barack Obama. He's a public figure. He's a big guy. He can defend himself. I mean, he's a big grown-up public figure, blah-de-blah. Whereas, you know, kids, when they sign up to be on the basketball team, they're not signing up to become public figures. Good point. But is this, for example, Bill Bennett, is this taking on a major public figure?
But I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to me like he's talking about national figures or Michael Savage talking about Islam, all of Islam, including the guy who lives down your block.
It's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill him.
Yeah, or Bill O'Reilly talking about Sean Hornbeck, the kid who was abducted and molested for a couple of years.
Than what he had under his old parents. He didn't have to go to school, run around, do whatever he wanted. When it all comes down, what's going to happen is there was an element here that this kid liked about his circumstance.
Yeah. And you know, the right gets a complete pass on this kind of stuff. So it startles me, frankly. It's that the rebuttal to my call for an end to all hate speech was the right saying, well, you know, as long as the hate speech is directed against major figures, that it's, you know, really no problem. Sorry. Hate speech is hate speech. The Bush administration has a new strategy in Iraq, creating gated communities. I'll tell you about that after the break, and we'll be taking your calls at 1-866-303-2270. Drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com. Visit our site over at AirAmericaRadio.com or AirAmerica.com. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartmann Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Listener-supported radio. The Tom Hartmann Radio Program, supported by you, our listeners, listening for the sponsors on your local stations and calling them up and letting them know you're listening and that you appreciate their helping support Progressive Talk Radio and supporting our national sponsors as well, like SacredGroundsCoffee.com, SmallDog.com, EcoWine.com, and Purina One Natural Blends at 866-380-MEOW. Amazing. The Karl Rove has to be smiling ear to ear with all this discussion about Imus. The number one thing on his list of things to do is get progressive talk shows and the mainstream media talking about something other than Gonzalez Gate and the disastrous war in Iraq and Bush and Condi Rice lying and all the other things that are starting to come out in the congressional investigations. And so I am, you know, I'm perfectly willing to discuss what's happened with Imus, but I am every other discussion is going to be about what's actually going on in the world as well. And if you call with a comment about Imus, you have to have a comment about what's also really going on in the world as well. Well, you don't have to, but please take a shot at it. I mean, this is again, I'm just saying, I think it's time for us to have an end to all hate speech, and it should all be condemned. For example, John Gibson on Fox News.
Now it's time for my word. Do your duty. Make more babies. That's the lesson drawn out of two interesting stories over the last couple of days. First, a story yesterday that half of the kids in this country under 5 years old are minorities. By far, the greatest number are Hispanic. Know what that means? 25 years and the majority population is Hispanic. Why is that? Well, Hispanics are having more kids and others, notably the ones Hispanics called gabachos, white people, are having fewer.
So get out there and have more babies, says John Gibson. Of course, speaking to white people, Pat Buchanan.
Would you prefer only white immigrants?
No, what I would like is, I'd like the country I grew up in. It was a good country. I lived in Washington, D.C., 400,000 black folks, 400,000 white folks, in a country 89 or 90% white. I like that country. We didn't vote to change it.
89 or 90% white. Yeah, he liked that. Or picking on women.
I have long told you, for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
Yeah, I say let's end all hate speech. Here's what the system of gating areas under foreign occupation. This is something that the French did in Algeria and that we tried in Vietnam. And that is creating these gated communities where we go. And in fact, there was a very, you know, nice fluff piece about this in the New York Times last week. In fact, I discussed on the air. We go into individual neighborhoods, 2-3 square block areas, and basically wall them up and create, you know, little narrow areas. And it is wrong. It's crazy. It's a bad thing. Chris in Ridgefield Park, New Jersey. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to also mention that Chris wasn't in charge on 9/11. Cheney was, which was at the school all day.
Yeah, Cheney and Cheney had been put in charge of the counterterrorism task force when he became vice president in January, and that task force never met until September of 2001.
Yeah. Now, with the NSA and the Patriot Act and these anti-terrorists and stuff, with the John Warner National Defense Act, they could declare military martial law. Now,
right.
With the Military Commissions Act, they could detain people. Now, if there's another terrorist attack in this country, can they declare martial law with the troops that aren't here? And can they detain American citizens that are on these lists and keep them because they're enemy combatants? Because, as Bush
yes.
said, you're either with us or against us.
Yes, Bush has taken that power, Chris. He's absolutely taken that power. And there are a lot of people very concerned about it. Interestingly, the people who seem to be the most concerned are the very, very conservative talk show hosts who are out there doing shortwave radio and whatnot. I was on one of those shows a while back. And they are absolutely flipped out about this. And people like Colonel Hunt. I mean, there are conservatives who are also concerned about civil liberties. And so I think that we need to actually, at a certain level, be reaching out to them and saying, yes, let's bring this in. Kathy in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Kathy.
Hey, Tom. Talking about Colonel Hunt,
mm-hmm.
He's not into civil liberties. He's partly responsible. He, along with Bill O'Reilly, some of the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan committing suicide.
How so?
They had a little yuck fest when the reports first started coming out about the veterans, about the troops being sent back, already diagnosed with PTSD with a pocket full of pills. And they had a yuck fest saying it wasn't true.
Jeez.
I was appalled when I was sent the link to the tape.
Yeah. Kathy, I'm very sorry to hear that. Thanks for the heads up. It's Fox News. You just have to figure anything goes, I guess. Sandra in Concord, Massachusetts. Hey, Sandra.
Oh, Sandra. Oh.
That's
it
you?
Me?
That's you.
Oh, it's not Concord. I'm calling from Concord, California. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. It's Sandra, who usually calls from Berkeley. And this is something I just got off the phone with Nancy Pelosi's office because I don't know. Have you read the book about Blackwater yet?
I had the guy who wrote it on the program and interviewed him, and I thumbed through the book. I probably read 10% of it. I haven't read the whole thing, but I got a pretty good description of it.
Well, the thing that really terrifies me about this book is we have a force of 200,000 people about that are loyal to Schmidt, Joseph Schmidt, and Prince, not this country. They have no loyalty to this country, and they're mercenaries. If we sent, it's almost like, Tom, that we're trying to destroy our army, and I've been seeing this for a while, but why would we do that? Why would we systematically try to destroy our own armed forces? Well, if we destroy them and they're not left and there's nobody left, what happens if there's an emergency in the United States? We'd have to hire Blackwater. And I think the Blackwater already, I've heard that, I live in California, as you know, and I already heard that Arnold Schwarzenegger is thinking about using Blackwater for some stuff. I do not want these people in our streets. I heard about the way they were in New Orleans. I do not want security forces that are loyal to some company telling me what to do in my country.
Yeah, absolutely. Security, the military, the army, the police functions of this country are the very last thing that should be privatized. I absolutely spot on agree with you, Sandra. Joe in Orlando, and thanks for the call. Joe in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I think that there's a much broader issue here regarding IMIS and these young ladies up there in New Jersey, and that's, this is really the beginning of a national conversation, because I hear it on all the radios. I drive a truck over the road, and people are just really going for this. But I think it's about really that we're tired of the hate speech. We're tired of this insanity, and this is the beginning of changing a dialogue that really messes us up both in domestic and foreign policy, because we don't do any critical thinking when we have these on the airwaves. You know, you've got IMIS and Howard Stern, and they're kind of like jock shocks that, you know, they try to make fun with using racism and stuff. But then you got these other guys, and they're very seriously dedicated to, it isn't anything to do with funny, they're very seriously dedicated to destroying this nation through their hate speech. And the thing that's moving this conversation forward is your show, Air America, C-SPAN, NPR, and other shows like that are having critical thinking processes going on that can help us get educated and see the different possibilities, along with this growing thing that's evolved between Terry Schiavo and then the Page issue. And, you know, we're really hitting people home. I mean, how many self-respecting people out there would allow their daughter or their niece or their sister to be called a whore?
Yeah.
And I think there's a real broad implication here on this, and I think we need to demand the firing.
No, wait, the firing of IMIS, yeah.
Because it sends that message home that needs to be sent off.
And odds are, you know, his advertisers are pulling away from his show right now, so odds are that that's going to happen, because ultimately GE is going to look at this as a business decision, and, you know, what's going to be the best for their business, and because you're not just talking about a show here, you're talking about a multi-million dollar industry that's called a show. But I spot on agree, and I think that what's happening, thank you, Joe, for the call, that we are actually beginning a national dialogue about this. Back in the 70s, when you had Roe v. Wade in the early 70s, and in fact back to the 60s when birth control pills first were legalized, were certified by the FDA, and you had the so-called sexual revolution, and then women's rights movements seriously emerged in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, there were a lot of people who were saying, and as well the civil rights movement out of the 60s, there were a lot of people who were saying, now that we are officially enfranchising minorities, women arguably are a majority, but nonetheless an oppressed group, now that we are officially enfranchising, let's stop with the hate speech already. And this then, in the late 80s, under, you know, as part of the whole Reagan campaign, this became ridiculed. This came to be ridiculed as being politically correct. How dare you be politically correct? We have political correctness on our campus. Oh, what? You mean I can't say hate speech anymore? And that was, and as a consequence of that, this whole right-wing talking point about, oh no, political correctness is a terrible thing, it became cool, I guess, to be politically incorrect, to be outrageous, to go in the other direction, and to, you know, essentially make a profession out of hate speech. And there are still people who are doing that, and I think it's time to say enough already. You know, this whole notion of political correctness has nothing to do with politics or being correct. It has to do with being civil in a civil society. And it's really a good time for us to return to that. And by the way, at the same time, 38 people have died in Iraq since Thursday, and let's not forget that. And let's not forget that Bush is trying to get a war czar so that he can get somebody else to take the fall for his lousy policies in Iraq. 45 minutes past the hour. Your calls when we come back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270. This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
I don't want millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
Here in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. You tell him, Tom Rush. Tom Rush, what a great guy. He, back when in the 70s, late 70s, Louise and I started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire. And for our 10th anniversary, which must have been 1988, Tom Rush was living in New Hampshire, and he came over and did a concert for us and for the kids. And it was just, and he was just absolutely one of my top two favorite folk artists, him and Tim Buckley, back in the 60s and 70s. And it was such a thrill. Anyway, we've been talking about hate talk. Just one last, and then I've got it all out of my system. Here's Michael Savage.
But basically, if you're talking about a day like today, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and you've got to understand what civil rights has become, the con it's become in this country, it's a whole industry. It's a racket. It's a racket that is used to exploit primarily heterosexual Christian white males' birthright. And steal from them what is their birthright and give it to people who didn't qualify for it.
Oh, because they weren't born white.
Out of whose hide all of these rights are coming?
White guys?
They're not coming out of women's hides.
White guys?
No, there's only one group that's targeted, and that group are white heterosexual males.
Oh.
They are the new witches being hunted by the illiberal left using the guise of civil rights and fairness to women and whatnot.
And therefore, all you guys who have lost your paychecks because of 26 years of insane conservative economic policies and offshoring and the end of tariffs and global free trade, you should be very angry, the subtext of this message, obviously, that people should be very angry at what, black people, African-Americans, at Muslims, at women? Man. At a certain point, you know. John in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, John. By the way, I'm going to be in.
Thank you for your program. I just want you and your audience to know that I'm a black male and I don't have a thing against white guys. I hope they live happy lives. And if that's Savage's point of view, it certainly doesn't apply to the black folks I know. But the reason for my call is, am I on the air?
You are.
Yeah, and I wanted to back up your comment, your notion that we shouldn't just concentrate on this Inez comment about the Duke players. I think it's very painful, but I think in a way it's kind of the race card, and excuse my paranoia, but I think in a way it's a way to divert public attention from existing problems plaguing the Bush administration and diverting attention away from the possibility of using nukes in Iran. And what really makes me laugh, what really amuses me, is a difference between the way the media, I'm talking here about the right-wing media, is willing to analyze in minute detail the origin, background, the environment of Inez's statements about those girls. But then they're so happy to give short shrift to denials of nukes in Iraq, to lies about told by the Bush administration concerning this war, questions about whether or not it was Al-Qaeda after all that bombed the World Trade Center. Those things aren't even allowed to come out, but they'll go into enormous detail. So in short, I think it's very possible that this is a diversion.
Yeah, another way to say it, John, and I would be rhetorically to ask the question, what did more harm? Imus's racist statement or Judy Miller's propagating the lies of the administration that
you
led to the death of thousands of Americans.
Right.
And, you know, they're both deplorable, but there is some scale here, and the latter is not even being discussed. John,
right.
Thanks a lot for your comments, and thanks for listening, and thanks for the call. Bill, and by the way, and thanks for listening there in Phoenix. I'll be there on Sunday giving a talk and doing a book signing, and I'll be broadcasting live from your station there on Monday morning. Bill in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bill.
Tom, I've heard you in Seattle, and it was well worth the trip down to Town Hall.
That was a lot of fun.
It was great. You sure do a good job of holding, better than almost anybody else, of holding up some of these conservative commentators to the light for examination. You know, you play clips of Savage there where he, you know, it plays the right wing blame and resentment game, lies and deception. But you know, he goes way further than that. I can't help myself. I want to see if there's a method to his madness sometimes, and so I listen to his show. He borders on genocide, advocating genocide. Jimmy Carter. I mean, not just high officials. Jimmy Carter should be drugged down to Gitmo in chains. The Democratic leadership should be taken out and put up against the wall and shot.
At a certain level, Bill, I think that you have to not to defend Michael Wiener Savage, but I think at a certain point you have to say, you know, it's theater. It's theater. And the problem is the people who don't get that it's theater.
Well, I certainly think that too, because I know people that I see people wearing a Savage Nation cap, or people I know that listen to his show say that, oh, people don't like him because he's from New York or he's Jewish. You know, it's just incredible. And I think this guy has said that I should be marched to the shore at the point of a gun because I'm a liberal. Yeah. You know, and I think the only answer to it is, I think the way to stop it is, you know, I think people have to take on the sponsors of these programs and boycott them.
Well, yeah, you could do that, or you could simply highlight it, simply, you know, point it out and say, you know, enough of this. But, you know, Bill, thanks for the call. Scott in Houston. Hey, Scott, we've got just a minute here before we've got to wrap up this hour of the show.
Okay, Tom, hey, enjoy the show as always. Hey, wanted to put a little spin on the Iraq war. It's not enough that Bush has basically screwed everything up, but you know, I think the Democrats could get a lot more traction if they put it in these terms, money. You know, if we're, my understanding is we spend about $14 billion currently a month in Iraq. You know, run that out through the month, you're talking, what, maybe $475 million a day. If the Americans realize that since we're running deficits, yearly deficits on a national basis, that's $475 million a day that we're throwing onto our kids and our grandkids.
Right, your share of the bill for this war.
Push that.
Right, your share of the bill for this war is probably somewhere between $800 and $1,500 a year right now, as a taxpayer. Yeah, it is amazing, and it needs to be highlighted. Nobody is talking about it, and you can bet that if the Republicans were running the talk machine, it would be being talked about all the time, every day, every minute. But you know, we've got to wake up a few Democrats, I guess. 57 minutes past the hour. Back with more news and your calls after the news at the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program, 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where being progressive never felt so good. And Joe in Brookings, Oregon, welcome to the program, Joe.
Yeah, well, I completely disagree with you about the subject of political correctness and the Don Imus and all that. Right now you have Bill O'Reilly calling for Rosie O'Donnell to be kicked off the air because she's supposed to be anti-American. And then MSNBC kicked off Phil Donahue because he was anti-American. The dirty little secret about political correctness, I think you had the right-wingers who started political correctness in the first place. I think McCarthyism and the Red Scare that started right after World War One with the Palmer Raids and Eugene Debs being thrown in federal prison for speaking out against World War One.
Good point, Joe. Do you think that I'm suggesting that what Imus did for it should be against the law, that government should be brought against him?
Well, no, not you, but you know, you said, well, all hate speech should be should cut it out.
I am suggesting that we should achieve a societal consensus about two things, and I really want to conflate these. Number one, that hate speech is no longer useful in our society, that particularly, you know, we have been attacked and wounded. I mean, you know, to use Bush's, you know, here 9/11 and everything. I mean, this is a time when America really needs to be looking together. We need to be looking at and working with each other rather than trying to divide ourselves from each other, as these cons have been doing for the last, you know, 26 years. Number one, we need to be looking together and working together. And number two, I would submit that it's a time that rather than saying we're going to make something illegal or like that, that we're going to have a societal consensus that it's time to have a conversation about some of the larger issues. Like, it's not just about whether somebody is dissing somebody because of the race or creed or gender or whatever, but it's also about whether the media is telling the truth about the real issues of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, as you know, one of the callers pointed out in the last hour, and I set the beginning of the last hour up with saying, you know, I'll talk about IMUS, but I for a minute, and then I want to point out, by the way, that 38 people have died in Iraq since last week. We can't allow number one, something to completely blow off the front page everything else that's going on, and number two, I think that we as a society, we need to be having this conversation about what's appropriate speech in general, not what's legal speech, just what's culturally, you know, what's our cultural consensus now, number one. And number two, about honesty and ethics in journalism, you know, about what's the truth. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'd go with that Joe. Your point is well taken, and I agree with you. It does go back to McCarthy. It absolutely does. That was the original, you know, attack on speech. I mean, that was the, and on the other hand, it was also the original hate speech. Amina in Mount Kisco, New York. Hey, Amina.
Hi. I wanted to thank you very much, Mr. Hartman. I wanted to point out that just what you were saying about how long this hate speech and this diversion from truth has been going on, and I think what happened personally is that the corporate, international corporate industrial complex has succeeded in taking over our media and has succeeded in diverting and causing division, and has literally, you know, bought and paid for the administration and the government. Because for us to be committing even more of our children to this horrendous thing, you know, invasion of a country, you know, that no one has proved, and the media refuses to look into, you know, why we're there and why nothing has ever been said, or why Saudi Arabia has never been approached for all those people who were documented as being on those planes to do this stuff. And we are pursuing this, threatening another country that had, you know, as far as we know, no documentation of having anything to do with it. And we are not even aware, we've been cut off from other countries who are not allowing their governments to participate in this, and who are not allowing their governments to send their children into something like this.
Yes.
We've been cut off from all other media.
Yeah, well said, Amina. And the mainstream media, the largely corporate media in America, doesn't want to discuss these things. Yeah, well said. Thank you for the call. Jim in Menlo Park, California. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, I had a question for you. I don't hear any of the media or any media reports regarding IMUS's conduct, about the grease man's conduct. About 10 years ago in Washington, D.C., he made a racist joke or played up a racial incident, and he thought it was funny. And as, from what I remember, he was immediately yanked off, fired, and apparently he's been off the radio for 5 or 6 years, but now he's back on. Is there any parallels with what the grease man did, with what IMUS has done, and why give IMUS
I have to confess, Jim, I don't even know who the grease man is. I'm sorry.
Okay, he's a morning shock jock. I think he competed with Howard Stern quite a bit.
I see. Okay,
I'm
sorry. That's beyond my realm of knowledge. But the question that you were asking when I interrupted you.
Was there any parallels, and is there any reason why IMUS, they should give IMUS the 3 days or 4 days until he's suspended instead of suspending him immediately? And based on
it's a good business decision. You're spiking the listenership to the show and the viewership to the MSNBC TV show throughout this week. And then, you know, 2 weeks off, I mean, you know, that happens all the time. People take a couple of weeks off. And when he comes back, the listenership will be very, very high again. So, you know, my guess would be that it's just, I don't know. I don't know what's going on at MSNBC or GE. But, you know, typically things like this are made as business decisions. So that would be my guess. I really don't want to attribute that to them because I frankly don't know. Lewis in Manhattan. Hey, Lewis, welcome.
Yes, Tom, let me ask you a question about sovereignty, sure. State sovereignty specifically. Mm-hmm. The state has a compelling interest to protect the people within its state, and it seems like they're giving up this sovereignty to increase the police power of the state. Now, if the state doesn't protect the people, don't the people have the moral right to go against the sovereignty like Thomas Hobbes said?
Well, or Thomas Jefferson said, actually, in the Declaration of Independence, it says not only do you have the right, you have the duty to overthrow a government which is oppressive. I mean, that was the statement that he made. The question
is Thomas Hobbes too, and you can clearly see where we're losing our state sovereignty if the state doesn't protect us.
Yeah, Lewis, there is a significant difference in the role that states played relative to the federal government before and after the Civil War. The Civil War was a profound recalibration of the power of states. Before the Civil War, we had strong states and weak federal government. After the Civil War and since the Civil War, we've had strong federal government and relatively weak states. It's change that came about in part as a result of the Civil War, in part as a result of both legislation and amendments to the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, and 15th in particular, that in a way were designed to prevent another Civil War. And this is where we're at right now. So, you know, this is the problem that a lot of governors have. I mean, you got the governor of Ohio here writing a letter to George Bush saying, you know, you're taking my National Guardsmen and women sending them off to Iraq. Please give them body armor. He doesn't have the power to say, no, you can't have them. I think it's a shame, but that's my whole point.
Aren't we losing state sovereignty here?
Yeah, well, it's sovereignty that the states haven't had since the late 1860s. But your point is well taken, and we've had a number of governors speak up and say we'd rather you didn't take our troops, and they're spot on. Pat in Midland Park, New Jersey. Hey, Pat, we've got about a minute before we got to take a break here.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling you actually two things, but one, I heard on your program and on the program before you the guy that was covering for Sam Severs on April 4th, a news item that supposedly was on ABC to start with, about us backing financially Pakistani rebels, and it had been going on for 2 years, and what they were doing supposedly was infiltrating into Iran and attacking their soldiers, and even some of the executions were put on the internet. Haven't heard it anywhere else.
This is MEC. This is it's a terrorist group. MEC is to Iran what Al Qaeda is to us.
What is it called? So,
MEC. MEK is the, I forget what the,
but there,
what
it
the
is
actual
happening,
name
in other
is.
Words.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's absolutely happening, and nobody's denying it, and it's well documented. It's not, you didn't just hear it here. I mean,
and I heard it on the first one. I haven't heard it anyplace else.
Yeah, well, I believe it was the Atlantic. It might be the Nation, or I think, or maybe even the New Yorker. Maybe it was Cy Hirsch who wrote about it. I'd have to go, you know, check the internet. But if you Google around, you'll find it without any difficulty at all. No problem. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Well, I was in the car and I heard this guy. He sounded all shook up and he told me why. His voice was a shame on the EIB. Sounded like an Oxycontin eater to me. It was a bug-eyed, tone-deaf, lying Oxycontin eater.
Right-wing,
strung-out, hypocrite, prescription cheater. Rush looked strange to me.
I think, you might then say that the obesity crisis could be the fault of government, liberal government. Food stamps, one of the biggest scams on the face of the earth. It was, the scam was to get everybody loving the United Nations.
Oh, food stamps are a conspiracy of the United Nations. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Now, this is an interesting old clip. This must be from the...
Scam was to get everybody thinking the United Nations is feeding poor people. Is what happens when you let the left run things, at least here in America. Didn't teach them how to fish. We gave them the fish. Didn't teach them how to butcher a... slaughter a cow to get the butter. We gave him the butter.
Yes. Butter comes from slaughtered cows, don't you know? Allegra in London, the United Kingdom, on the line. Hey, Allegra, welcome.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
I can.
Hello?
Very well, thank you. I can hear you.
You can?
Can you? Yes.
Yes, hi. So I'm a little bit nervous. I'll make this short and sweet. Back to this Don Imus situation. I mean, don't get me wrong. What he said was absolutely abhorrent. I'm a black female. When I look at how black people are portrayed through these so-called black music channels, I mean, why is it okay for black people to use the N-word and portray women so... in such a degrading manner in these videos and not to get criticized for it? I mean, I sometimes wonder what white people must be thinking when they see those kind of videos and stuff. I just wonder what they must think. I mean, to me, it's disgusting. You know, to come across as inarticulate. You know, all this thing with the bling-bling, calling women bitches and all this nonsense. I mean, I hate that black American thing. It's disgusting. I mean, don't you think they should be taken into account over this?
Yes, and interestingly, Allegra, what's happening in the dialogue here in the United States is as a result of Michael Richards' meltdown, where he was using the N-word repeatedly, and it got captured on TV, and frankly, I think, you know, the small good that may come out of what happened with Imus.
Yeah.
Is that there is a discussion in America about exactly what you're talking about. In fact, I read an op-ed piece this morning, I forget who wrote it, but pointing out that the consumers of the kind of rap and hip-hop music that by and large degrades women, and particularly African-American women, is the largest consumers of that, more than the combined consumption in terms of purchasing that product. If you combine African-American men of all ages, African-American women of all ages, and white women of all ages,
yeah,
teenage white boys buy more of that than those three groups combined.
Yes, but,
so,
yeah.
And they're the target audience right now. Teenage white boys are the target for this stuff that seems to be being marketed into the African-American community, but they're the ones who are principally buying it. And I think that what's coming out of this is a conversation in America about, you know, at what point should we be drawing lines across the board in our media? Mm-hmm. Again, not by force of law, but by force of cultural pressure.
Yeah, because I just want to end by saying, because what's coming across to me, because I've listened to quite a lot of liberal and right-wing talk radio, I mean, what comes across to me is if it's okay for these black music stars to use the N-word and portray women in this way, and they don't seem to be getting criticized for it. And I feel that, you know, this should be addressed.
Yeah.
You know,
and
it's not okay for the black community to use the N-word and portray women in that, you know, in that way and come across being articulate and... You know, I just hate the whole black American music scene. It's, you know, it's disgusting. I just feel it should be addressed.
Yeah. Well, I think that, Allegra, and thank you very much for your call. And for,
thanks very
and
much. Thank
and,
you,
and for listening to us there in the UK, I'm assuming, on the Internet. That conversation is starting to happen. And it's starting to happen as a result of these things. As I said, I think that the pendulum swung so far to the right in response to, you know, there was this original... A notion of let's be civil to each other, and then the right came along and said, "Oh, wait, being civil, that's called political correctness. You can't have that." But there's a power structure in place. Marcus in Yorba Linda, California. Hey, Marcus.
Yeah. Good afternoon. I just first of all I want to say that I was ready to jump all over your case, and then what you just said to that young lady gives me a little hope in that I find political correctness to be reprehensible, in that when I listen to rap and there's this vitriolic, venomous assault against blacks and Africans and Jews and the police and women, calling them hoes. You know, I'm half American Indian, half Irish. I'm an Air Force veteran. I serve this country. I believe very strong in free speech. You know, I do not like censorship. I wasn't offended by what Don Imus said because I think that he's just a goofball that says stupid things, and I hear stupid things from people every day. But the bottom line is, if we get, when I go out and protest against the war, and I'm in the anti-war movement, I've had some people, some women come up, and they start telling me that I'm not saying the right thing, and they start trying to be the thought police and the speech police. And that really, really scares me, Tom, because I think that we have to live in a country. Who are the people that decide what we say and who dictates what's right? And
well, that's my point, Marcus.
Line?
It shouldn't, I suspect we're agreeing. It should be a matter of cultural consensus. It shouldn't be a matter of literally the thought police, of having, you know, of making this an instrument of government. And you know, yes, freedom of speech. And let's be reasonable here. Let's be appropriate in this country. It's time for an intelligent conversation. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
It never fails, you let the fox run in-house. What did you expect? You've been looking for your chickens, but you ain't seen one yet. Only thing that I don't know is why you're so upset. You let the fox run in-house, that's what you get.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Let me just clarify that point, because it's interesting. David, my producer, and I were sitting here as we went into that break, and David said, you know, I agree with the caller rather than your position on this. And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm not saying that this should be at law, that there should be, I'm saying that there should be a cultural consensus that we need to redefine the norms of our culture explicitly. And that happens, by the way, not by virtue of anybody saying, this is the new rules. But it happens by virtue of cultural consensus. And he's like, well, you know, if people don't want it, they shouldn't buy it. And I said, that's exactly what I'm talking about. For example, if somebody were, you know, there's a cultural consensus in the United States that Hitler was a bad guy and Nazism shouldn't be glorified. If somebody did music that glorified the Holocaust, nobody would buy it. It would be shunned. And that's my point about this, that it should be that's what I meant when I was talking about a cultural consensus. Congressman Earl Blumenauer and Congresswoman Hilda Solis are with us. Congressman Blumenauer representing the 3rd District of Oregon, Congresswoman Solis representing the 32nd District of California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Hey, Earl. And Congresswoman Solis?
Yes, how are you? Buenos dias.
Well, buenos dias. Thank you very much for being with us today. The two of you are working on this this forum, Establishing Federal Priorities for Global Warming. Congressman Blumenauer, can you tell us, first of all, where, you know, what's the venue here?
Okay, thanks. Well, Hilda and I were both appointed by the speaker to the new Committee on Global Warming and Energy Independence and the economy. We are having a session this afternoon at Portland State University in Portland that involves local experts in Portland, Oregon. We have a couple of utility executives from local companies that have been active. We have academics and citizens to spotlight work that has been done in Portland. One of the frustrations with this administration, they've walked away, not just walked away from Kyoto, but don't have any program themselves as an alternative. And we have hundreds of cities around the country that are taking the lead. And we're looking forward to spotlighting that today, and hopefully using it as a prototype of hearings that we want to have around the country.
Well, and in fact, Portland is one of the few cities in America that is actually Kyoto compliant. We are in compliance with Kyoto in this city.
Yeah, for the last four consecutive years, CO2 emissions in the city of Portland on a per capita basis have declined, and we think this sort of demonstrates that we can do this stuff. We want to spotlight what's happened here, and then think about how we carry that to federal policies.
Congresswoman Hilda Solis, how did this come about, this conversation, this forum? Congressman Blumenauer said that Nancy Pelosi, you know, appointed you to this commission, but what was the genesis of this?
Well, she's always been talking about our work needed on the environment, and how under the last at least 6 years under the Bush administration, we've really seen a digression in terms of EPA's role in terms of helping to prevent many of the egregious things that we're seeing now all come to fruition. In fact, there's a proposal to cut the EPA Environmental Justice Office out here on this side of the coast to shut it down. And we just had a really meaningful discussion with the roundtable of people representing different communities, environmental justice communities, because that's a big part of an element of global warming. In fact, any of these impacts will hit hardest on low-income families and neighborhoods. So it's very important to have that role. And I believe that's why Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker, placed me on the committee, because of my work on passing the first environmental justice legislation in the state of California. And after that, we have been successful in getting other states on board, and now we have a proposal that's going to be introduced in the House. It actually has been introduced in the House.
I'm familiar with Congressman Blumenauer's district because I live in it. It's Portland here. I work in it. I actually live in Darlene Hooley's district, which is right next door. But the California's 32nd district represents what area?
It's East Los Angeles and the San Gabriel Valley, and it has, I can tell you, three Superfund sites, major water contamination, major air problems, air pollutants in the air, and it's just one of those parts of the valley there that got left behind, and it could really serve as an environmental justice community, and we really need to fix that, because it's not just systemic in places like L.A., but also across the country. We see that in New York, we see it in San Antonio, we see it in Miami, we see it even in old Midwestern towns where cleanup and blight still exists. There's no relief for brownfield cleanups. EPA has been negligent in helping us attack the problem of cleaning our air and our water.
Do you see, Congresswoman Solis, do you see any impact coming out of this recent Supreme Court decision that said that the EPA may enforce carbon dioxide regulations?
Well, I believe that it helps to provide that added support that we're going to need when we have our hearings and when we hold the EPA administrator and other folks and industry. When we, you know, talk about major changes, we're going to have some leverage there, I believe. And I think it's going to be really important. But here's Mr. Blumenauer.
Just one footnote on that, Tom. What was, I think, significant about that ruling was that it sort of kicked the underpinnings out from some of the people who may or may not be doubting about global warming, but they doubted that the federal government would ever do anything. This means that the last excuse that the Bush administration had to stall on this has been knocked away. There have been businesses that have started. We had a dozen businesses and environmental organizations unroll their proposal a month ago, and as part of our forum here today, we have a president of a local electric utility and a local gas utility that are stepping up. I think this is shifting the momentum, and that it wouldn't be possible without that Supreme Court decision, that 5-4 Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, and the four were the two role models that Bush said he would, you know, Thomas and Scalia for future appointees, and then his two appointees, Roberts and Alito.
Absolutely.
Which tells us how scary and how important it is that that somebody rational be in the White House. That said, Congressman Blumenauer, when the Environmental Protection Agency was first put into law by a Democratic Congress during the Nixon administration and signed into law, frankly, I think proudly by Richard Nixon, who arguably was in some areas actually a liberal, I guess. Looking back, I mean, it's you know, times are weird when you're nostalgic for Richard Nixon. In any case, from the time that the APA was put into place until Reagan, the EPA really was, you know, they were doing a good job and they were growing, and there was a consensus right across the United States that this was a good and desirable thing. Reagan started the war against government, that government is a bad thing in and of itself, period, and regulatory agencies by and large shouldn't exist, this sort of pseudo-libertarian, you know, right-wing whack job perspective. And now we have an administration that is stacking regulatory agencies like the EPA with people who have spent their entire lives and careers trying to destroy regulatory agencies. Do you have any hope for federal action outside of congressional action? In other words, do you have any hope that the EPA will begin taking these things seriously, or is it going to take congressional action? And if so, does Congress have the power to actually determine and define the boundaries within which agencies that are under the executive, like the EPA, act?
A great question. And it is certainly, we have been swimming upstream for the last 6 years with these amazingly egregious appointments. And but several things are happening that make me more optimistic. First of all, the wheels have fallen off this administration. It's not just the Department of Justice where the spotlight has shone with such a searing effect. We're watching, you know, Griles, somebody we've been, you know, the deputy administrator for Interior that we've talked about with you in the past, Tom. You know, he copped a plea. We're finding out that people are in fact pushing back. We're winning even with the current judiciary. We've been winning some cases, some lower court cases, not just the Supreme Court. So the combination of the Bush administration's lack of credibility, a re-energized, democratically led Congress, and frankly, your point about, you know, a lot of these environmental issues weren't as narrowly partisan before Reagan and Bush. I'm going to meet later this week with Teddy Roosevelt IV, a Republican environmental leader who's been given heartburn by this administration. So I think these are a series of things that are coming together that make me more optimistic that we don't have to wait for a new administration. Congress and the public can force these folks to stop the bad stuff and maybe even do some good things despite themselves.
Yeah, it sounds like a marvelous thing. Are there going to be, Congresswoman Solis, we only have about 20 seconds left here. Are there going to be others of these kinds of forums around the country? Are you going to have some in California, for example?
I believe so. In fact, I think we even want to use the state-of-art teleconferencing and really try to get more people involved. I mean, these are things that we have at our disposal, so we need to use them and bring people together to show them the new face of Congress and the new direction that we want to go in terms of the environment.
Well said. Congresswoman Hilda Solis of the 32nd District in California, Congressman Earl Blumenauer of Oregon's 3rd District, thank you both for being with us today.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour. Up next, Talk Radio News from Washington, D.C. And also, if you have questions for a White House reporter, feel free to give us a call at 866-303-2270. Tom Hartman with you, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Oh, no, it's the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 9.5 minutes before the hour here on Air America Radio. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom, that is such a great song.
It is.
What's
up in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, let's see. The White House is trying to appoint a war czar. Apparently, the problem is that the president's having difficulty running the war, so he's going to have somebody run it for him. This war czar would do just about everything. He would oversee the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I say he because I don't know that they're actually considering any woman for the job, although, to be fair to the president, he does consider women for high positions within his administration. And so far, everyone's turning him down.
Yeah, yeah. Who wants to be a czar? The question that I have is, how can you have a war czar? I mean, the Constitution says that that officers of the United States must be confirmed by the Senate. It's in Article 2 of the Constitution, you know, the part where basically it says the president may propose members of the Supreme Court and officers of the United States, but they must be confirmed by the United States Senate. And that has been interpreted to mean his cabinet. And are we talking about adding a cabinet position here? And if so, if this person, according to, you know, the article that I read this morning, is going to be responsible for both the Department of Defense and the Department of State, is this person an uber cabinet member? Is this a sub vice president? I mean, what's going on here?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and I would think that his hope would be that it's somebody who is, does not have to be confirmed by the Senate.
Sure.
I mean, why have somebody confirmed if you can avoid it?
So what we get to here, and this is my take on this, Victoria, is that what Bush is trying to do by having a war czar is his original war czar, his first one was Colin Powell. Colin Powell sold the war. Colin Powell took the heat for it. Colin Powell retired in humiliation. His second war czar was Don Rumsfeld. Don Rumsfeld, Bush kept saying, Don Rumsfeld's running this, and the generals were also, but Rumsfeld was the lightning rod. Rumsfeld is gone. Gates has made it very clear in the press that he's not gonna take the flack that Rumsfeld took, and he's not gonna be the fall guy. And so all of the heat now is falling on Bush. I'm of the opinion that Bush is looking for somebody that he can prop up and say, here's the guy you should throw the water balloons at, not me.
Yes, I think that's probably right. But he would also like somebody who could win the war.
I don't think so.
I don't think he wants to win the war?
I think deep down inside they all know that, A, the war is long over. We did win the war. Now we have an occupation. And, B, unless you want to be absolutely mind-bogglingly, incredibly expensively repressive, you can't successfully occupy another country over any period of time. I mean, that's why all the colonial powers have withdrawn their colonial armies from Africa, from Asia, from the Middle East. Why we've taken our armies out of Central and South America. Colonialism doesn't work.
I think that there are those in the administration who do see that. I'm not sure that the president sees that.
That's pretty scary.
I think he has his own vision.
Yeah, that's pretty scary. Hey, we've got a couple of callers with questions for you. Sarah in Los Angeles, you're live with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service.
Hi. If I hear one more white person make the analogy between rap music and these idiots like Imus and Rush Limbaugh, today is the day I lose it. My brain is going to explode. I'm wondering who all these middle-aged white people are that listen to all this rap music. I'm 50 years old and have black nieces and nephews. I don't hear that much rap music. Rap music is not, gangster rap is not being played over the airwaves of any radio station that I know of, because those airwaves are public, and as such, they are governed by the rules and regulations of the FCC.
Well, I hear it, Sarah, if I may interrupt you, I hear it here in Portland, and as I said earlier, it is the primary market for that kind of music is white teenagers.
You do not hear gangster violent rap on the radio. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You don't hear it. I have to disagree with you.
All right.
Well, and I have to plead innocent. I was on MSNBC this morning talking about this subject,
right,
and I didn't mention gangster rap once, so I'm innocent.
Sarah, thank you for your call. Tom in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom. My question is, why hasn't Congress reinstated the whistleblower program so that people working in the administration could come forward and point out some of these crimes that these people are doing?
My understanding is that they're in the process of doing that.
Reinstating a whistleblower law?
I believe
so. Or giving it teeth? Yeah.
I believe yeah.
Another bill for George Bush to veto or put a signing statement on?
It's going to be very difficult for him to veto that one, I think.
Yeah. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York, you're live with Victoria Jones.
Yes, thanks very much. Victoria, when the president makes statements that are demonstrably false, as he's been doing since last week, saying that if the Democrats don't give him a bill, soldiers will have to stay on longer tours, or they'll have to stay in Iraq longer or go back in a shorter period, when that's actually already happening, does anyone ask the president's spokesperson about these contradictory claims?
The spokesperson does get asked about those contradictory claims. Absolutely. You would be surprised. It's definitely worth watching the briefings on C-SPAN. The press has smartened itself up and brightened itself up in the last two or three years, and those kinds of questions are now asked.
The problem is, number one, that Bush makes those kind of statements in venues like the VFW where there are not reporters and nobody's going to ask a question. And so his statements get reported as if they were, the voice of God speaking from the mountain, on the news. And two, when the reporters ask those tough questions and who is it, Dana now, dances around them, that doesn't get reported.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, very little
of what she says gets reported. So it is news that I really don't know, because you've got 45 minutes of news when she's doing a Q&A with the press, And a good 30 minutes of that really is news. And I don't know how you report that. I don't know how you get that much out.
Because the typical newscast at the top of the hour is now 2 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah, in radio and on television, you know, at the most you've got a half hour with the evening news, and it ends up being 18
minutes.
You've
got to get the Duke Lacrosse case in, Anna Nicole.
Yeah, there you go, indeed. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Henry Clippinger coming up next. What is the future of individual identity in America?
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes, as Phil Proctor and the great guys at the Firesign Theater point out, everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Everything you know is wrong, by the way. Our segment is sponsored by theliberalstore.com. All things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Check out the liberal teddy bear there now. That's the liberalstore.com. John Henry Clippinger is with us. He's the author of A Crowd of One, The Future of Individual Identity, a new book. John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
I don't know where to begin with this, but this is a rather sweeping view here. Starting out with the concept of individual identity in society.
Right.
And I should note that your website is crowdofone.org. There have been, over the last 300-400 years, a whole series of recalibrations of our understanding of who the individual is relative to society and what the role of society is relative to the individual, whether it's to dominate the individual, control the individual, restrain the individual, or support the individual. What's the frame that you're using for this?
Well, the point I was trying to make is that, particularly in recent Western society, and so there's a post-enlightenment, the individual has been primary, and we've sort of seen the individual, we think of the individual as against the group. And there's a presumption that whatever an individual does, they define their own identity, and by virtue of their efforts, they're entitled to certain, privileges. There's been a heavy emphasis of the individual separated from the group. And I think that the modern science, particularly sort of the biology, evolution biology, and neuroscience has been saying that people really take identity as something that involves in the context of a group. It's something that's not self-assertive. It's not an either-or thing. So a lot of this is a political, I think, confusion or contention that exists right now is really a byproduct of that kind of dualism, and sort of creating the contrast between the individual and the group.
For example?
Well, I mean, the fact is that we will say, well, you have to defend the individual against the group. Now, in other words, if you take the extreme conservative view, and say, well, you know, it's all about, you know, we say you go to a libertarian view or someone like an Ayn Rand kind of thing, and say it's all about, and people should be self-interested, selfish actors, and that is how public good is created. Or the Chicago School of Economics and saying that we're self-interested, rational actors. That is not true. I mean,
this is exactly what, you know, after Bill Clinton, when he ran for president in 92, he ran on a platform of being an FDR Democrat, and he was elected on that platform. And now we know that 2 weeks before his inauguration, Alan Greenspan and Robert Rubin sat him down and said, now we're going to tell you how the world really is. Alan Greenspan, who was inducted into Ayn Rand's little cult in her apartment in New York City in the 1950s, 1956, as I recall. And Clinton completely recalibrated what he was doing and went in a completely different direction for the following 8 years of his administration, or a largely different direction.
I don't think he went in a completely different direction. I don't think he became a total free market economist by any means. But that's why
he pushed through NAFTA and GATT and WTO. He started dismantling welfare. That's why he started talking about this is the end of big government as we know it. You know, he started mouthing the Reagan rhetoric.
Well, I don't think that's the framing that I question in the book. It's sort of framing big government or the individual, and I think there's a new ground here and a new way of conceptualizing, a new way of thinking about it. A lot of it is embodied in evolution and biology, and I think you'll find a new generation of economists who are what they call behavioral economists and neuroeconomists are breaking away from sort of the traditional classic economic model of the rational actor and saying that people actually have an innate sense of other regarding behavior. This is something that's not an anomaly. This is not something. Actually, people have a proclivity to do that, and that there's real advantage in having cooperation rather than just everything being sort of self-interested action. But that's not all the time. I mean, there are cases in which, you know, you have to act on your own self-interest. So it's a question of being more rationally understanding where the parts between markets and competition and cooperation evolve. And how you
I think John, we're getting way too didactic here. let's reduce this to a practical and understandable level. It sounds like what you're suggesting. Yesterday, for example, in this program, I was talking about how in nature, we assumed for a couple hundred years that nature, in fact, this was one of the original arguments at the founding of this country. Jefferson wrote nature's God into the Declaration of Independence. Adams thought it should be the Christian God. Jefferson said, no, democracy is the natural state of things, of humans and of everything else in nature. Turns out recent research finds that that's actually true, that alpha animals, alpha male, in some cases alpha females, have first choice of sexual partner, but that's it. They're not actually the leaders in most cases. Actually, in most societies, most animal societies, decisions are made by a majority, by a democratic process. And that's the natural state of humans, to be part of a society, that we are essentially social animals, that we can't separate ourselves from society. Is that the point that you're making here?
Yeah, I think it's not always a quote a democratic process in that sense, but it is a set of cooperations among, and it isn't just,
process.
Yeah, and that there are very elaborate forms in which coalitions form within a social species. And yes, so the caricature of having sort of an alpha male or female to dominate everything is not accurate.
It's not accurate for humans.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And not only that, but it doesn't lead to the best outcomes either. I mean, so there are a class of economists who are saying, you know, you get better outcomes if you have some forms of cooperation. Rather than this pure competition or pure self-interest. I think there's a thinking of really rethinking how these two things go together.
Are you suggesting a middle ground between what in political ideologies would be referred to as radical communism on the one hand and radical libertarianism on the other hand? You know, it's all about, you know, everybody is subservient to society and to the greater good, and society determines everybody's life in the radical communist sense, and the individual determines everything, and it's all self-interest on the other hand. And you're saying somewhere in the middle, are you suggesting a middle point between FDR?
Well, it's not just drawing things in the middle. I mean, I think there, yeah, I mean, certainly not either one of those, but there are ways in which I think you can design social networks, social societies, and monetary systems and currency systems to accommodate so the balancing back and forth of the different needs of the individual versus
give me an example.
Well, I mean, I think what you're seeing is in a lot of organizations. I mean, what's interesting to me is things that, as I mentioned, the book done work with the Defense Department of all places, you would think. But the whole idea of how creating network organizations and flattening command and control, rather than having it be centralized, you're giving a lot of decisions to people in local situations. And so that's by giving them the decisions and giving the decision rights, they can do things without having to go through a central authority. At the same time, you have to be very careful how you allocate those, because they have to be they have to work as a whole. The whole network has to be together. So it becomes really critical who trusts whom under what kind of conditions. And I think you can explain a lot of how do you create networks of trust. It's become a key element.
I'm assuming you're familiar with game theory and all the stuff that came
right. I mean, it's evolution of game theory, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, game theory predicted, you know, in for example, the the one famous experiment, I forget the name of it now, where you know, you had to betray people in order to
win.
What's
a tit for tat? It's a prisoner dilemma.
Prisoner dilemma, right, the prisoner dilemma. In the prisoner dilemma, when they actually tried it with secretaries at the RAND Corporation, it never played out the way that they predicted. It never played out the way the computers did. And they found that the only two groups of people who would do the prisoner's dilemma game the way that they predicted were sociopaths and economists.
Well, I mean, there's a variant of that called the ultimatum game, which they did actually. There was a series of cross-cultural studies that were done in 36 different cultures, and the assumption was, is homo economicus, you know, the whole idea of the rational, is that something that's true? And they found it wasn't. That right. People tempt to try to do something that's fair. They're more sensitive to preserving a norm rather than maximizing their own self-interest. And it's true. A number of experiments they found out were surgeons and economists were those people who defected on their own self-interest.
Yeah.
And so you have like a 25% pathology is what they find.
Yeah.
And
John Henry
society.
Clippinger
okay.
is the author of a new book, A Crowd of One, The Future of Individual Identity. John, thanks for being with us
Thank
today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, say hi. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman program, 21 minutes past the hour. John Sununu, the guy in the middle. Tonight, in all probability, the Senate is going to vote on stem cell research. Now, the Senate has passed this law before, saying that federal funds can be used on embryonic stem cells for research to cure some of the worst diseases that plague us all. However, the last time it was passed, Bush vetoed it, and there were not 67 votes in the Senate to override the veto. So if the bill passes by 66 votes, you know, it's not veto-proof. And it'll die when Bush vetoes it. Turns out that the one guy who's standing in the way is apparently Senator John Sununu. So it might be a good idea. The senator from New Hampshire, by the way. It might be a good idea, if you're so inclined, to give Senator Sununu a call. And, you know, if you feel strongly about this issue, one way or the other, frankly, and let him know your opinion. You can call Congress at the toll-free number, 866-220-0044, or 220-0044, 866-220-0044, or you can call them, they're just the main switchboard, 202-225-3121. Area code 202-225-3121, which is probably the best number to call on, and that'll get you the Capitol switchboard, and you just say, I'd like to speak with Senator Sununu's office, please, and politely tell them your thoughts, whatever it may be. You know, if you're opposed to stem cell research, I understand. It's just an issue on which I think that the good senator from New Hampshire should probably be hearing from the American people, since he apparently is the vote which will decide which way this whole thing is going to go. So we'll see how it shakes out. Conservative Brigham Young students are protesting Dick Cheney's speech. This, you know, another interesting story coming out of Utah and Salt Lake City. Dick Cheney, a morally dubious man. George W. Bush trying to find a general who will be his front man for the war, the ongoing occupation of Iraq. Three four-star generals have now said thanks, but no thanks. And on it goes. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi. Hey, regarding that guest, when you were going back and forth with him and you guys were trying to find the middle way, and you talked about the extreme left, which was defined as communism or collectivism, and the extreme right, which would be, I guess, fascism and corporatism. And he failed to realize that the New Deal was the middle way between those two poles.
Well, that was the point I was trying to make to him, and in the middle of that sentence, he interrupted me and went off in another direction. And,
right,
and
but
I never got back to it.
They always try to define the left as the New Deal, but the New Deal is the middle way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I'm not, you know, I don't know what this guy's politics are. I thought this was an interesting take on the relationship of humans to society. As you know, and the biology of it. Frankly, you know, looking back on it, I think it was a little too impractical, and not enough of how do we make this real? But
I'm always reminded of the quote by economist Galbraith, who was an advisor to FDR, and he was saying that the modern conservative is always searching for a moral justification for selfishness.
It's sort of a paraphrase. Yeah,
and that's where they're always doing that. But anyway, I wanted to remind you, tomorrow, you know, is the 62nd anniversary of FDR's passing. So,
well, thank you for the
reminder. I want to remind everybody about that.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you, Tom. I appreciate the call. By the way, speaking of this whole issue, and then we'll get back to your phone calls, but I have to share this with you. This is so cool, because yesterday we were talking about this time of day. We were talking about how democracy is in our DNA. It is in the DNA of every, I would argue, every living thing. Certainly in the animal kingdom, we can see it quite clearly in the DNA of everything from insects to the high apes. And it's in our DNA as well. And there's been this historic question of how did civilization emerge? And, you know, when we went from being hunter-gatherers to building cities. And the argument that's been put forth for a long, long time by serious anthropologists is that it came about as a consequence of war, that the natural instinct of humans was to have war, and therefore war brought about the need for cities to defend and protect. Now they found a 5,000-year-old city in Peru, and that has been buried for thousands and thousands of years. And they actually found, this is from the BBC. Crucially, there is not the faintest trace of warfare at Caral. This is a mother city, the original city. No battlements, no weapons, no mutilated bodies. Instead, findings suggest it was a gentle society built on commerce and pleasure. In one of the pyramids, they uncovered beautiful flutes made from condor and pelican bones. They also found evidence of a culture that took drugs and perhaps aphrodisiacs. Most stunning of all, they found the remains of a baby lovingly wrapped and buried with a precious necklace made of stone beads. No sign of warfare at all. In fact, this whole BBC documentary is about how these people lived for 1,000 years with no evidence of warfare whatsoever. The origin of civilization. 27 minutes past the hour. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, 34 minutes past the hour. Hank in Cardiff, California. Welcome to the program. Hank, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Question. Midterm recall on the ballot as a constitutional amendment. Some folks and I have been kicking around this idea. It would read constitutional
amendment. At the federal level?
Hello?
At the federal level?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
In other words, you would institute on every ballot the following, automatically year after year, recall the President of the United States, yes, no, recall the Vice President of the United States, yes, no, and then recall, and, you know, if there were two senators in your state, one or two who happen to be in midterms, do the same for them.
Why?
And just make that a standard thing on every ballot.
Why?
Why? Because what we're seeing here is an election this past November that was intended to send a message to the president that he didn't get. And we also see a heavily politicized Congress that does not have the will, even though it seems to have the means, to remove someone who really ought to be removed, him and the vice president together, through impeachment. So the process seems to be broken at the moment. I mean, if there's anybody who needed to be impeached, it's these two guys.
Yeah, well, here's two quick thoughts on that.
It isn't happening because everyone's fearing repercussions. You know, the Democrats don't want to look like, impeachers, I guess, and the Republicans are just laying in wait to kill them if they try it. It would be a whole different story if the voters did it.
Well, yeah, and number one, there have been over, I think, 19,700, as I recall, amendments to the Constitution that have been offered, and there's only been 20-some-odd that have been actually ratified. You know, fewer than 30 have been ratified. It has to get through three-quarters of the House, three-quarters of the Senate, two-thirds of the House and Senate, and three-quarters of the states, I think, whatever, as I recall. It's just, it's a process that takes forever and probably wouldn't happen. But perhaps more importantly, let's put this in context, Hank. You have... In the year 2000, Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush did by any measure, according to the New York Times and the consortium of news agencies that actually counted the ballots in Florida.
Sure.
On top of that, you had massive election fraud by the Republican Party, by Jeb Bush, that disenfranchised some 70, 80,000 mostly African Americans in Florida. Plus you had machines that were rigged, plus you had ballots that were designed and in many cases sabotaged in ways that caused people to think that they were voting for Al Gore, but the hole that they were punching ended up being for Pat Buchanan, whoever the right-wing crank was on the ballot at the time. And the consequence so what we're looking at here is not a failure of the democratic process with regard to we need to have a mechanism to throw the bums out. What we're looking at here is the theft of an election. And the same thing happened in 2004 in Ohio. You have two people who've already gone to prison in Ohio because of rigging the election in Ohio. There's no way that George Bush won Ohio. And you go back and you look at everything that was done. I mean, they even rigged the recount so that it couldn't be found out. They're just beginning to turn over those rocks and discover that. If we simply had laws in place, very strong laws that said we don't have these DRE machines that can be hacked into and that can be rigged. We have same day registration for voting all across the United States. We don't have draconian hoops that people have to jump through in order to register to vote. Because voter fraud, the Republican canard is about as off, happens about as often as people getting hit by lightning. And we had strong laws and started throwing people's butts in jail for election fraud like the Republican Party did up in New Hampshire. One of the ways that Sununu got into office by jamming phone lines so that the get out the vote effort for the Democrats, was unsuccessful. And you have a Republican win by just a few thousand votes when, that effort would have made the difference. What we need to do is stop election fraud. Not provide a mechanism to throw bums out of office who've been elected as a consequence of election fraud.
Well, I don't think one necessarily runs contrary to the other. I mean,
I'm saying the will of the people was actually quite reasonable over the last 6 or 7 years, and it was thwarted by a criminal enterprise in the White House. That is now in the White House, that was called the Republican Party. I mean, you've got the Republican Party that has been operating under a restraining order for 2.5 decades with regard to caging, and they're still doing it.
Yeah.
So, disenfranchising these people. So, anyhow, I'm not opposed to your idea. I just don't think that getting a constitutional amendment, I've started down this road back 8 years ago when I wrote Unequal Protection. And, let's get a constitutional amendment to fix the 14th Amendment to say that corporations aren't persons, that the definition of persons is natural persons, doesn't encompass artificial corporations. And that's when I got into learning about the process of changing the Constitution. And I'll tell you, the process of changing the Constitution is something that amending the Constitution that is just mind-bogglingly difficult. Hank, thanks for the call. It's thought-provoking. I appreciate it. Bill in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for listening to our flagship station here, KPOJ.
I'm going to change the topic to creationism and science.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I hear people talk, and I have this comment. A lot of times people who believe in science attack the creationist viewpoint. I personally have never had anyone who believes in creationism who can give a good definition of science. Of all our knowledge, science is just a very small part of our knowledge. You have intuition, you have empirical data. You might like pizza, but it's not a scientific, point of view.
correct?
I you know, if you want to get very esoteric and you want to get into philosophy here, I mean, you could argue that we ultimately don't know anything because our, you know, photons strike your eyes and your eyes convert that into a, through a chemical reaction into electromagnetic activity that goes into your brain that's converted to chemical activity that causes you to think that you saw something. I mean, you know, ultimately we don't know anything. But the fact of the matter is that there is this paradigm, this structure through which we filter information that is testable and that is replicable to say, yes, this is true, and no, that is not. And that body of science is pretty clear that the world was not created 6,000 years ago. I mean, it just comes down to that. I'm not going to re-debate that. Parker in San Luis Obispo, pronounce that for me, Parker.
San Luis Obispo?
Thank you, San Luis Obispo. What's up?
Well, I was just thinking about how I think we're over-atomized as an economy and as a society, and that's kind of in line with what you were talking about earlier. And I just wanted your thoughts on the ability of a atmosphere trust to sort of establish some links through the future in our economy, like like the Alaska Commons, where they take the, you know, just by virtue of being a citizen of Alaska, you get a share of the government, the state's oil lease money.
Right.
And the ability.
The problem with thinking of it in those terms. First of all, I would say we do have an atmosphere trust. It's called the government. It's us. It's our collective society and the government that we have. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why we had the Clean Air Act, for example.
Hey, how come I didn't get a vote on that?
Yeah. Well, you actually voted for a member of the House and a member of the Senate and for a president who brought that about or in nowadays changed it, you know, destroyed it. But the problem with the Alaskan model is they are sharing the wealth of, you know, of the mineral wealth of Alaska, that is the oil, with the Alaskan citizens, but they're not sharing the cost of that with the Alaskan citizens. That oil gets burned, and it's changing our atmosphere. The Alaskan citizens are not paying in dollars. You know, they're not paying back out of the revenue that they get for that.
It creates
cancers all over the United States. They're not paying for that. So
right.
it's a classic case of internalizing the profits, externalizing the costs.
Well, the strange thing about that now is that actually the northern latitudes are affected more by burning of oil than anywhere else. So in some sense, that counteracts your argument. But
It's
ironic. But the idea that we should be able to say let's quantify these externalities, you know, of us burning oil, and make people pay for that privilege of polluting the oil or polluting the skies and then sharing those proceeds with us. It's just a way of saying instead of getting free externalities that you're going to pay people to get that, and when that becomes public money, which is, you know, goes to the people who most need that, you know, like...
Right, it's what we do with tobacco taxes to fund health care.
Right.
You're taking the externality of tobacco, that is, you know, the downside of the use of tobacco, which is that people get sick and die, or they get sick and they need health care, and you're saying, okay, if you're going to use tobacco, you're going to pay for some of the health care that's going to come along with the use of the tobacco. But I think that, and Parker, your phone is really breaking up badly. I appreciate the call, though. I think that I would say that we do have a climate trust. It's called our government, and we need to take control of it and be doing something appropriate about it. Dan in San Diego, California, got about a minute before we got to take a break, Dan. What's
I just wanted to talk about the Don Imus thing, and a couple of the British caller a while back, you know, triggered a couple of points. One of them you hit on. You talked about who the majority consumer is of hip hop, being white out of less than sin. But also in addition to that,
and gangster rap.
Pardon?
And gangster.
Or gangster rap, yeah. And in addition to that, you know, like who controls the music industry, you know, it's owned mostly by white males, you know, and who's
yeah.
making most of the money. But beyond that, I don't recall.
It all gets back to the man, ultimately, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I don't recall the caller's exact words, but she inferred, you know, if not explicitly saying that, you know, that portrayed, you know, what was portrayed in those music and videos is black culture. And I keep hearing that repeatedly is sort of a theme, and that's not the case. I mean, that's not what... You
yes.
know, that doesn't represent black people or black culture any more than like Britney Spears, Anna Nicole, or Girls Gone Wild, or any of those things represents white people. And oh, also the other caller who said that gangster rap doesn't get on the air. I think you might have missed her point. I think it doesn't get on the air because of you know, vulgarity, violence,
obscenity laws. Yes, some of it doesn't get on the air. Much of it does, though. Dan, thanks for the call. Well said. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us. The latest headline over at the Huffington Post: Pentagon may extend tour for all 145,000 Iraq troops. And you wonder why Bush is unable to find a new war czar. JR in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, JR, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I've got a suggestion as far as a way to deal with the hate speech and misinformation when it comes to public broadcasted stuff. I mean, it's already in place. You have a rating system for books that essentially, if it's a fictional book, it has to go fall under fiction. It's listed as fiction. If you watch a film before
actually,
the
there's
film
no law
starts,
of that effect, JR. There's no law about that. That's simply, you know, the policies of the industry. That gets back to what I was talking about earlier of you know, the power of social consensus.
Well, yeah, I understand that portion of it, but I think that the responsibility has gone. I mean, it's too important to just leave to corporations to do the right thing. That's like asking them to do the right thing as far as the environment goes. I think that there has to be social responsibility, and I don't believe that an individual who is an extension of a corporation who's being paid by this corporation falls into the same category of free speech. You know, I mean, I don't think that they should be censored, but at the same time, they do censor rap music when it comes on the airwaves. They bleep out the material that's offensive,
yeah,
and they put
it
on
it actually does, yeah, gangster rap does get... They actually, they'll issue two CDs, one for play on the air that has moments of silence where they use the F word and things like that, or else has a bleep in it, and that's what gets played on the radio stations, on the most popular radio stations, by the way, and
yeah,
you know, in terms of music stations. And then the CD version has the actual obscenities in it that people listen to in their car. But the point is that you know, with regard to fiction and nonfiction, that, you know, you'll recall the case of the guy who made up the story of the I believe it was a heroin addict, a woman. There's this whole long story, a former New York Times reporter, and there have been several of them actually, where publishers published books. There was the Oprah book recently, where the guy, you know, was broken into a million pieces or something like that, where, you know, the guy just made up the book. It was fiction. He was peddling it as nonfiction, and what happened was that there was such a strong social consensus that we want to know, is this really fiction or is this really nonfiction, that ultimately the author and the publisher weren't able to get away with that. And I think that that's where we need to get with this whole spectrum of stuff, from what's said on the radio on the one hand, and I would include not just speech that is denigrating particular groups or whatnot, but I would say, you know, speech that is openly false. You know, for example, Fox News promulgating the myth that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. That kind
well,
of thing.
Exactly.
There needs to be a social, but I don't think that it should be legislated. I think that there should simply be such, and I think, frankly, it's arising. I think it's happening right now, that social consensus is coming forward. You've got all these Democrats now who are saying, no, we will not debate if Fox News is moderating it, because we know that they got a political agenda. They're a phony news organization. And so that's how it happens, and that's what I'm calling for more of is, you know, I think that to the extent that IMUS has done anything useful here, it's that it has cracked open an opportunity for us as a society, as a culture, to have this conversation and about, you know, what kind of discourse do we want to have in our society? And I think that that's a healthy conversation to be having. Bill, you're going to have to pronounce your city there, Bill, for me.
The Okanagan Highlands.
Ah, Okanagan Highlands.
Yeah.
Welcome.
I was listening to that fellow you had on yesterday who was talking about being on alternative energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think about how absolutely imperative it is that we get universal health care in this country if we want to make a shift to a more green, sustainable future.
Or if we just simply want to make a shift to a more reasonable society. I mean, it's
well,
37
it's
industrialized
that.
Countries in the world.
I mean, I'm over here. And if I do everything right with my bio-intensive mini farming and my organic beekeeping and my pasture-raised livestock, I will be very, very fortunate if I can make $20,000 a year net.
I mean, that's doing really well in this neck of the woods. There are a lot of people who would love to do the same sort of thing that I'm doing. But if you're paying $600, $700, $1,000 a month for health care, you can't do it.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And it's wiping out our for-profit health care system is wiping out the ability of people to start to be entrepreneurs, to go out and start things on their own. It is making it very, very difficult for people to change jobs. They're afraid that their new job, they're going to have the pre-existing condition from the last job, and now their new insurance company won't cover what their old insurance company did. People are afraid to get divorces. It just goes on and on and on. It is a huge social constraint that's entirely wrong and entirely inappropriate. Good point, Bill. Thank you very much. Dan in Denver. Hey, Dan, we've got about a minute before we've got to wrap up this show here today.
Okay, real quick. I'm a Teamster here in Denver. Two big concerns. First, the Mexican truck deal, letting the pilot program in with thousands of Mexican trucks spewing 333 times the amount of sulfur in American fuel. Big environmental nightmare.
You know what this is about? This is really about two things, Dan. It's about thumbing their nose at the EPA and our clean air regulations, and it's also about busting unions.
Yes, it is. And the second point, hopefully everybody will call their senators and congressmen. They should be able to get bipartisan support to kill it before it starts next month. And I've got a real problem with the Democratic National Committee putting the 2008 convention in a SCAB facility.
I didn't know that they were doing that. In Minneapolis?
In Denver.
The Pepsi Center is
owned by Stan Kroenke, a Walmart person who is vehemently anti-union, and where they're putting the convention.
Dan, thanks for the heads up. I'm going to track that one down and get a little more information on that. That's interesting. I appreciate the call. Hey, tomorrow I'll be confronting Angela McGowan about her book Bamboozled. She says Americans are being exploited by the lies of the liberal agenda. Richard Bush is dropping by on China's challenge to America and the possibility of China becoming the world's next superpower. And the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.